the
single most important
I can see about four areas.
Now, are we ready to go again?
Right.
I think the single most important thing, and one of the reasons why we had a tax in the legislature, is the strength of the Board of Regents. And I've mentioned here how there have been almost ceaseless attempts, and some of them from the people working in the executive branch of the government, and people working, not the elected officials, but the people working in the for the legislative branch, have attempted to, one way or another, to tell us where we can get our insurance and what sort of contractual arrangements we should have and shouldn't have, and this sort of thing. Some of these have been pretty minute. In fact, I have a note on my desk: "You fire this man." Period. But we have roused some frustration in individuals in the legislature, and there have been really attacks made upon the backbone of the whole state university system of higher education, namely the existence of the Board of Regents. And there's been drive to separate the university so that they can break it up into smaller bits, and they'll have a more direct influence than on the bits, because they could use them as a part of a political football game, you see. And this, I suspect, is going to crop up again this year with great force. There'll be a lot of tension, so you might watch for it. Now, the governor have, interestingly enough, all three of them, I think your record will show, have appointed about as many from the rival party as they have from their own party, which speaks very well, I think, for the objectivity and the very high respect which the university's operation is regarded by the chief executive officers of this state. Their objectivity in selecting what they consider to be people that can do the job, men and women of top caliber. This has been one of the most encouraging things about coming here, and of course it just must continue unless you want to make higher education a part of the political football game of the state.
One of the humorous questions we're going to ask you was whether, in your career as a professional basketball player and coach, whether this art of dodging and ducking and attacking and defending has been helpful to you as president.
Well, I look back upon my years in athletics and competitive sports as being extremely valuable. I, both as a player, but more particularly as a coach, I coached high school basketball in pretty tough leagues in the Iron Country, in the Copper Country of Northern Michigan, and then in Iowa and Illinois. That I think the coaching, one of the great experiences for any young man. If you can teach, it shows up on the playing field, on the playing floors. Every weekend, the test is given before the whole public as to whether you taught your players anything or not that week. It's direct, it's immediate, and it's exceedingly painful if you haven't. I can't think of any training experience that is more meaningful if you're going to be an administrator than the experience of coaching a team. I think that's more experience, that's more important than the playing itself. The playing, you learn how to work with others who are on the floor or on the field with you at the same time. And that's, I think that's perhaps the most important thing you get out of it. You learn a great deal of human psychology. I think I've learned more psychology on the field of sports, competitive sports, than I could ever learn out of a textbook in the field of general psychology. And I know that the scholars will laugh me off the face of the globe for this, but there is a story by Rudyard Kipling. It's a story of polo. I think the scene is laid in India in the days of the British domination. It's called The Maltese Cat. It's the greatest short story that was ever written about sports. I included it in one of the anthologies that I think Harcourt Brace or J.P. Lippincott published for me many years ago. And it has been acclaimed as the greatest of all, because almost all of the psychological situations that can occur in a competitive sporting situation, competitive sports situation, is revealed in that one short story. I commend it to you. I think you'll like The Maltese Cat by Rudyard Kipling. It's the story of a polo game. And I think it illustrates what I'm saying here, the tremendous importance of competitive sports to really understanding human psychology. All of the emotions are accentuated, even to the very controlled emotions. They're accentuated in a competitive sports situation. And it's just a good learning situation for an administrator, as I see it. You learn an awful lot. You learn so many things not to do. And you learn, too, that you can't really have a successful team effort if everybody is in on calling all of the signals. Now, everybody may have an input as to what signals are called, but somebody has got to take responsibility for calling those signals, and somebody has got to be the leader. You can't have a leadership of the whole and succeed.
One of the things that's obviously in the news now and has been off and on, I guess, for 10 years now, is the relationship between the University of Alaska Anchorage and Alaska Methodist University. Do you feel that we're have competed with Alaska Methodist University?
No, we've upheld them. We've tried to get them into a survival position. And I hope you keep this off the record. They've resisted it mightily and steadily. You see, for a private institution of higher learning to succeed, it must have some touch of realism in its ideological framework and its idealistic approach to life. It must come to grips with determining just what it is that they want to do and for how many people. And it must be some unique contribution, something, maybe it's approach to general liberal arts education, or maybe it's some exotic native cultural's program, or maybe it's a school of medicine, a professional level something or other. But they've got to do something that the public institutions cannot do as well are in the same manner, in the same special manner. This AMU has never been able to face up to. They've always tried to do, but whatever it is, it was succeeding in the public institutions, and at about the same level of competence. And of course, they have no way of taking in all of the customers. Their notion is, if you'll just get out of Anchorage, we'll get all these students and we'll succeed. Well, the realism in the case is that beyond the optimal number for their existing faculty and facilities, which they were funding, additional students simply drop them deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, because an institution always spends much more on a student. At one time it was about $1,000, it's about $1,500. I'd say by another year or two it'll be $2,000 you would lose on every student, over and beyond what you'll get from the student himself in his tuition, because there's a limit as to what the student can carry. All right, so step number one was to define their unique program. Step number two was to establish what the optimal level of the operation was to be. Step number three is to build a realistic budget. Maybe you can get 50% of this annually from student fees, if you're lucky. Maybe you can get 25% from state and federal contract arrangements, or you do something of a special nature, you're going to get special funds. Maybe your approach is so unique, so different. Maybe you've abolished departments. Maybe you have just team teaching. I don't know what it is. Maybe the students do their own learning. It's a self-study or something. But whatever it is, it's different from that which is more or less typical or standard or customary. And you can have to come up with that other 25%, and I'm using gross figures here, from the private sector. So you've got to be willing to undertake to raise from private giving some percentage of your total budget. And they've never faced up to this realistic formula for success. And there isn't any other way that that private institution or any other one can survive today. That's the way all private institutions survive. That's the way all of them. If they're just simply doing what the state university or the community college or the state teachers college or the municipal university can do, the evening school, the summer session, this sort of thing, just runs them deeper and deeper into debt. If they're only teaching mathematics the way everybody else teaches mathematics, and they can't take care of all the people who want to study that mathematics, then they should keep the hell out of that business. You see, I not spoke of a single study here. I should be speaking of programs, mm-hmm. of programs. You see, now, if this could ever be established in AMU, and it could work out in the consortium with the University of Alaska Anchorage. That University of Alaska Anchorage, with its access to the bond vote, could very likely provide all the additional classroom and office and laboratory facilities that they'll ever need at no cost to them, and maintain and operate it at no cost to them. We're going to be building for $15,000. If they want to use it for $3,000, fine, we schedule it so we can. I think if they ever exceeded 1,000, it would be a long time from now. But let's say they wanted to go 3,000, I'd love it. It doesn't have a bit of impact on our numbers. Not a bit of impact on it. And I like it as an outlet. There's some people just don't like to go to a public institution. They want something special. The reason they go to the place is because it is special. But if it's offering exactly the same thing as they could get in a public institution, then the private institution is lost. The only hope it would have is that it has the professor who was a Nobel Prize winner in the psychology, and so people went to him because he was special. Again, they would be offering something unique. They would be offering that highly specialized quality that couldn't be matched in the public institution. Okay, we never have had this realistic approach. They've always said, you get out and leave us alone because you are interfering with us. You're competitors of ours. Nothing could be farther from the facts of life than that attitude. Nothing.
Would you envision something like the Canadian college system, where there are actually religious colleges associated with the provincial?
Well, most of the provincial, I'd like to see that. I saw it over in Australia and New Zealand. They're largely residence and student activities and a little spiritual living sort of thing. I'd love to have somebody take over the dormitory system and the student activity system. It's wonderful. I think the Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders have got something there. But actually, the instruction that they get at Trinity College, for instance, University of Melbourne, are what's the one at Sydney, University of Sydney. There's not much instruction except in ethics and moral living and religion as it's applied to today's living. They really don't get into the sciences, even into the humanities and the fine arts, and they don't get into the social sciences in any except this specialized way. But they do run the dang-gone dormitories and the dining commons. And they run the what little athletic program that they have, you know, the running and soccer and this sort of thing. They don't compete as institutions. And I think they got something there. I think they've got something. Yeah, I'd love to have that.
How do you foresee the development of the university in Anchorage vis-a-vis AMU? Do you see that the university may be slowed up in developing some of its programs like the law school because of the need to support AMU?
We have been slowed up to the point of embarrassment now, simply because we have not been able to get a place to put buildings. And I go back to the fact that I'm accused of being a builder, and I take great pride in this. It's simply, you have to have the modern facility with sophisticated new equipment, or you can't get top quality people to work for you. And without top quality faculty, you don't have any real outstanding programs, old or new. And without the facility with the faculty and the program, you don't have any point in diluting the students. You don't need any students. So you have to begin where the beginning has to be made, namely with the facility. That's first. That's first. Actually, you have some of everything as you go along, because you have to have a few good faculty in order to give you ideas of what kind of a building that you want. And you do have some students. It all works in. But your main thrust to get things developed has to be with the facility. No other way. All right. Yeah. We have been held up for 10 years. Actually, for over 10 years. On getting the land that we wanted in Anchorage, because of the people that were going to back a private institution and get a great Harvard of the North that would be paid for by the Methodists that lived outside of Alaska. This wasn't very realistic thinking. And now they are blaming me for not having the facilities and the faculty and the program to take care of their great need. And it is great. So you'll hear more about this, I suspect, during the course of the year. That's all Wood's fault. That if you hadn't spent all that money at Fairbanks and elsewhere in the state, we could have it in Anchorage. Well, this again is pretty myopic.
Would you say that one of the real difficulties with AMU is they got involved in programs like nursing that are very expensive, and that soon after they're begun, the federal programs, the federal support drops, and they're stuck with a program that's expensive and...
Well, this wasn't a very good thing for them to do, probably. However, they could accomplish it if they would have followed the formula that I laid out. To find the unique function, if nursing was education was the unique function, University of Alaska isn't doing anything like this. It wasn't contemplating doing it. In fact, we didn't even think there was a need for it at that stage in the estate's development. There may be now. Okay, It isn't the nursing that did it, although it was, in my judgment, unwise for them to get into it for the reasons you state. Basically, they did not stick to the formula of coming to grips with what their unique contribution to the state was. Again, they were institutional oriented and, I think, personally oriented rather than service oriented to the state. What can we do that the state can't do as well for itself? They'd never have done this. Until they do, they have really no raison d'être. I think that's the French for it.
Changing the subject a little bit, the university seems, at least outwardly, to be free from the tremendous town-gown conflicts that have racked other universities. Do you feel that, say, your personal involvement in community activities such as the hospital foundation, the clubs, and the other developments that you've been involved with, and faculty members have been valuable in gaining at least some understanding of the university locally?
This, of course, is very real. There has been a close association between myself, Ms. Wood, and the community. We're involved in many things. And I think this has been on a truly unselfish basis. It has been a genuine concern to be of aid to the community. On the other hand, I will have to say it was done knowing that if we help people, people would support us at the university. So it was in the interest of the university this was done. But our effort has only been a small part. It's extraordinary how extensive our faculty participates in the community affairs. Now, I wish this would be of our young faculty as well as the more senior faculty. But I suppose you have to live here a few years before you get into this, because we do have a segment of the faculty that almost ignores the community. And these are the same ones who wonder why the university doesn't do more for them. And there's a direct correlation here. As I stated, it's the people who do something for others that have others support them when they have ambitions and needs. And while this is a general thing rather than specific I'm talking about here, it's very real. Now, the other thing is that the university has provided something in the last several years for the community that the community could not provide for itself, namely a cultural center. The Library of Humanities and Fine Arts did more for Fairbanks than it did for the university, and it's central to the university. It's the heart of the higher educational setting here. And without the university, you didn't have that. Second, it has provided the core, if you will, of a scientific community. The emergence of these great research institutes has tended to draw into the area the federal installations. Some of them came of necessity, such as CLEAR, the Bemused at CLEAR. But actually, the development of Gilmore Creek was the University of Alaska influence here. And we also drew the ESRO satellite tracking thing. And we have, as a result, become the center for a pool of scientific and technological expertise that makes it the unique community in the North. The unique community. All right, we've done that for them. We have tended to, in a scientific sense, professionalize the community. Remember now, we've become its cultural center. We've also become the center of its scientific cadre, and it's important enough that when there is a great need for scientific personnel elsewhere, we have half-page ads in the local paper. In a small community like this, big companies like Boeing and Douglas Aircraft will run half-page ads in the Fairbanks Daily News. All right, now the third thing is the most practical and most immediate of all. And that is that we have been increasingly a major portion of the economic base. I'm not certain, but I would say that probably one out of every three persons in Fairbanks depends in almost wholly upon the university for his livelihood. I put families. One out of every three families in the community depends wholly upon the existence of the university. All right, now this means that we're putting into the local economy $1.5-2 million a month. We are by far the biggest single impact on the community. The airlines and the military are the other two. And then I suppose the fourth one would be the tourist, overall the tourist mm-hmm. business. But those are the three things, the cultural, the scientific, and the economic. All right. Now, this is offset by the fact that we're also, because of our existence, an added expense to the community. They got to do things a little bit different plane. They've got to have better stores, better stock. They've got to have better restaurants, hotels. They've got to have better transportation in and out of the city. They've got to have, frankly, there is a direct impact on their schools that they have to simply take care of additional people, and the demands on them are for a pretty high level of educational program, elementary and secondary level. They've got to have better health services in the community than they did have. They've got to have better safety and security services, the fire and the police protection. And so it's by no means an unmixed blessing to the community. All these good things that I talked about first are in part offset by the additional costs mm-hmm. of getting them. The taxes would be much lower in Fairbanks if the university were not here mm-hmm. because they would not have to provide the range or the quality of services that they now have to and do willingly, I'm sure.
You must be in the enviable position of most college presidents of being feted by the townsfolk in the upcoming week or so. It seems to me that most college presidents are not being celebrated by their related townspeople, but are in fact being heavily criticized.
I tell you an interesting story. When I was a boy about 10, we left a big farm north of Alexander, Illinois, and we moved to a small farm which we had rented, several hundred acres, and a very fine place where I grew up as a boy. And we bought a farm, 120 acres or something like this, 10 miles south of there, about 12 miles south, at a place called Murrayville, also in the prairie. And we moved from one farm to the other farm in the middle of the winter in February. That was a very memorable occasion for me because I got to stay out of school and changing schools, and I got to help with all the hustle and bustle of taking the not only the furniture out of a big old 10-room house, but taking the farm equipment and you know, going through a livestock sale. We had maybe 100 head of cattle and 30 head of horses and this sort of thing, and then getting packed up and ready for the move from one farm to another. And I never will forget, my father looking out on the morning that we were to make this move, to see all of the wagons, the horse-drawn wagons that were lined up. This for the days of the automobile. This back in the just right after World War I. 1917, I think it was, 18. See them all out there, and there were more wagons than we needed. And he said, you know, a man never really knows what his neighbors think of him until he gets ready to move. They're always glad to help you on the, on your way. I think maybe that is an answer to the question you raised about the local interest.
Maybe in just closing,
it's a kind way to get rid of the old boy, you know, this sort of an attitude.
maybe in closing, what do you see maybe as a major directions of the university in the next few years? And say, in this budget retrenchment, where do you see our funding coming from, and how does this affect the development of the program? And just kind of a perspective of what you feel for the university in the next few
years.
That's
almost too difficult to answer, because with the increase in population, it seems inevitable to me that the university will have to move up on the priority list of things which the state decides it must have, and that we will have to get a somewhat larger percentage of whatever the state's appropriation is, and live with it. Now, I think we're going to find ways of increasing our output as far as instruction is concerned. We may have to cut some of our special programs of instruction in order to stick to the fundamentals, and to do this in terms of a much larger productivity ratio on the part of the individual professional person who is doing the teaching. We may do this by a variety of innovative ways. Educational television, a study on your own and take an examination sort of thing. The use of larger lecture groups, again backed up by the readings and examination, and by a use of individual counselors and tutorial system in part, which you'd think is expensive, but if it's a part of the whole complex of large lecture and educational television, it may well not be. I think we're going to have a tremendous modification in the calendar of the university. The one we have now is not very satisfactory. Neither was the one it superseded, but it was a better one in my judgment. We could have a much better calendar. Perhaps the most significant thing that may happen to us is creating a lower division unit through a community college type or general college type of an arrangement, and then the upper division program beginning probably about the sophomore year, in which people who can meet the educational qualifications for entry will come directly from high school into that, and they'll get a baccalaureate degree in 3 years, mm-hmm, rather than in four. The others will come in through the community college gate, and they may go off at the end of 1 year or 2 years with a technician training type of thing, or say 2 years an associate degree and that's all I need, and then they will enter the so-called academic disciplines and the professions. But we'll reduce the amount of time that the initially qualified people have to get their baccalaureate degree. Mm-hmm. This will be one of the ways in which I think we can increase our productivity. Now, also, the fact that we think of education more and more as a thing that goes on and on and on, and is not just for a whole lifetime, but is not just contained in a 4-year or 3-year or 2-year span, is significant. I have a notion there'd be much more of a spread out of education. You may go a year, you may be out a year, you may come back a semester, be out 2 years, and you know, mm-hmm, and take a course at a time while you're working, sort of, mm-hmm, thing. And that's a part of the again of our outreach type of program, where we do it not only off this campus, but we do it throughout the morning, afternoon, and evening hours. We do it through every month of the year rather than through September to May. Mm-hmm. Every month of the year. I proposed on the calendar to Theophilus a 1-3-1-3-1-3 program, which we begin the 1st of September with a 1 month, one course sort of thing for all those that are ready to come. And you can make this most innovative. Then you have 3 months through December up to Christmas, which is essentially what our first semester is now. Only you would take only about 3 courses, not 4. Mm-hmm. Then January again. And we have a lot of people that would be able to take advantage of us coming in 1st of October. Mm-hmm. You see, they've finished the fishing season, they've finished the construction season, they're ready to come. They can't come the 1st of September, so they lay out until the end of the first semester. But if they could, if you split it up in a 1-3-1-3-1-3, you actually, a lot of people are going to be able to graduate in about 3.5 calendar years, even 3 calendar years. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about really a year-round type of operation here, making it at the convenience of the individual rather than the individual adjusting himself to the convenience of the university. Mm-hmm. It can be done, but I think in a completely satisfactory way for professors. In fact, may give them again a chance if they've got something they want to do for the month of September that they might not have to start until October, or maybe they might not want to start until the 1st of January, or maybe they want the month of January off. Mm-hmm. You see, we get a great deal more flexibility in the calendar arrangement. Of course, in the evening program, the outreach program, that's any time of the day or night, any day of the week, and any month of the year that we start and end. Now, I think with this comes one other thing. It's a change of the rigid pattern in which we schedule our classes on 50-minute class, mm-hmm. and a 10-minute break, or 2 50-minute periods for a laboratory with a break halfway through for a few minutes till you go out and get a drink or go to the toilet or something. I think that we may go to some sort of a module a programming concept, such as some of the leading high schools in the nation have. Remember, Curry taught up here from Evanston Township High School this summer. He taught them. He said they broke up their scheduling from 8 periods a day of 40 minutes with 10 minutes in between, or 5 minutes in between, whatever it was. They broke it up into bits, 10-minute bits, I think, or maybe 15-minute bits. And let's say you had a math class that typically had been meeting 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, from 9 to 9:50. Okay, this time you may meet a part of the class only, may meet on Monday for 30 minutes, 3 bits. Mm-hmm. All the class may meet on Wednesday for 7 bits, 70 minutes. And once you have figured out what sort of a program you want for each of these subjects, and how many, then you put it into your computer and you work out the number of sections that you need and what the schedule is going to be. So you won't be going to the same room at the same time of day 3 days a week. You may be going to different rooms, different hours a day, in different groupings, and allows them to put together like elements from several disciplines under joint teaching. It adds a great deal to the flexibility. Yeah. So we probably will be looking at the possibility of changing this rigid pattern that we now have of scheduling of classes to a much more flexible arrangement, where some of the class may get together for something different from what you get all of the class together. And you may have a lecture once a week rather than mm-hmm. that runs for an hour and a half, and may involve 3 different faculty people lecturing for 30 minutes apiece. Mm-hmm. then you may break this up into 15-minute sections, even using your graduate assistant, for questions and answers, or a little quiz to see if you got the gist of the thing. Or some people may be off writing a paper in the library. What we're talking about is to try to break up the rigidity into a much more flexible pattern, which will allow for individual differences, for team teaching, for a variety of approaches to mastery of the subject matter, to understanding of the discipline, then is it all possible now? And again, I think it will contribute to maximizing the output, productive output. Mm-hmm. So these are the things I think we'll be looking at.
Very good.
I've talked of this through very awkwardly because, frankly, I couldn't draw a picture of this on paper for you. Mm-hmm. But I think we've got the minds on this campus right now that can do what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we should get at and study.
Well, I would like to thank you very much. I know that you felt